Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Angela Alberti.
Hello, Ivy Podcast listeners. Thank you so much for tuning into another episode of the Ivy Podcast, wherever you're tuning into and from. We thank you guys for joining us in today's episode. I am your host, Angela Alberti. You guys may have had a chance to listen to a few of the episodes that I've had to do. You know, we're all about the staffing industry, the workforce ecosystem, everything that's involved with putting people to work every single day. And that is a very nuanced subject. It's not just putting people to work, but it's also making sure that you have your receivables and overall financial health down. That's exactly what we plan on talking about in today's episode. I'm really excited to sit down with Wilson. I've known you for a few years. Can you give an intro on yourself, please?
Well, certainly I'm Wilson Cole. Most people will know me as president of Adams, Evans, and Ross, or either Backdoor Hiring Solutions, which is our software company.
Wilson, thank you for joining. You've been a recognizable face within the industry for a certain time, and we're going to be hitting on a very important topic, and that's the economic outlook and especially top of mind considerations as a staffing industry owner in these times. But I'd love to preface it a little bit by giving the audience more of an idea of your background, a career timeline, if you will. Can you give us a little bit of a dive into what's led you to where you are right now?
Well, certainly I've done credit and collections pretty much my entire career. For the last 30 years, I founded Adams, Evans, and Ross. And in the last 27 years, we've worked solely in the staffing and recruiting industry. And, you know, a lot of things have changed, but a lot of things have remained the same. But through the years, Adams, Evans, and Ross is the oldest company. We have added in additional companies in divisions. One, you know, 5 or 6 years ago was we created software that finds backdoor hires and misplacement fees. But over that, you know, last 30 years, we processed about $1 billion of staffing and recruiting debt through collections. We work with about 3,500 other staffing and recruiting firms. About half of our clients are recruiters. Half of our clients are staffing and temporary firms.
Wow, that's fantastic. And think about that for a second, guys. Over $1 billion in collections debt. And when you think about the industry, we're looking at an industry that requires a lot of cash to do what we do, particularly on the staffing and temp side, right? And with an average DSO that sits at 54 days. So this is a very critical topic. Couple that with the economic outlook that we have in front of us. Wilson, I want to pick your brain on, you know, put yourself in the mind of a staffing agency owner. Sure. And we're in this weird quasi recession. Are we in a recession? Are we not in a recession? We see that the job growth is doing great. People are getting hired, but we also know how the market is reacting and some of the outlying political and market conditions that we find ourselves in. What is your take on it, specifically from the angle of an agency owner?
Well, certainly. Well, first and foremost, let me say that I'm a very optimistic guy by nature. We're going to talk about some things where I have some concerns, but it's more of where I want you to focus on, because I think I think right now for staffing and recruiting, it is the biggest opportunity in the history of ever to be in the staffing and recruiting industry. And for a lot of folks that are my age and above, and I'm 57, a lot of folks know the same thing I do. Back in the early 90s, everybody talked about, you know, when the baby boomers start retiring, there's not going to be enough workers. And so staffing and recruiting is going to go through the roof. Well, I think that's happening right now. I think there's a few things that are kind of accelerating that. But with anything, wherever there's amazing opportunity, and I do think that there's amazing opportunity, but there's also, you know, opportunity is leverage. It can go very well. It can go very bad. And so agency owners, especially if you are providing temporaries, you almost need to view, and not even almost, you need to view it as though you're loaning money. So you have to follow those same practices or find a way to reduce your risk. Because if somebody picks up the phone and they were to call you and they say, "Hey, Angela, I want $10,000. Here's, I'm a nice guy. Here's three people that I paid over the last year. Can I come by and pick up my check?" You'd hang up the phone, you'd laugh and talk about the crazy person that just called you to borrow $10,000. But if they picked up the phone and called you for staffing, that in essence is exactly what you do when you send that temporary out. You may have higher margins and things on those lines, but you do need to follow some pretty basic practices to reduce your risk. So that's kind of the overlier of some of the things, just as far as on the concepts. And I'm not sure if there are specific questions that you want me to kind of go down, but that's the biggest thing of just realize that you're loaning money. Now,
I love that you said that, by the way, because I don't see that often enough. I think that's a great analogy that lets us set the tone into really the amount of cash flow that's needed on the temporary staffing. And I realize that it's not the same on the direct hire side, but if we look at the industry as a whole, this is a $500 billion industry. A vast majority of that is found in the contingent worker, temporary project contract, whatever it is that you want to call it, that type of space, which basically, as you put it, is a form of lending cash. And it's a large reason why so many staffing startups fail ultimately at the end of the day.
You know, the interesting thing is, you know, the SBA did a study back, I don't know, probably 10 years or so ago. And the number one reason, not why people thought they went out of business, but they went back and analyzed companies that did go out of business. And the number one business or reason why people actually shut their doors wasn't from lack of sales, wasn't from lack of opportunity. It was either they outran their cash flow or they made poor credit decisions and took too many losses to recover. So that's the biggest thing. And like I said, I'm an optimistic guy. We're going to talk about some scary stuff today, but it's just like anything else. If you have some systems in there, you can find some ways to mitigate those risks and create additional opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. So then let's set the tone a little bit about where we are today. We all saw ourselves probably with our jaw dropped in 2020, thinking, what the heck is going on in the world? Yep. And how are we going to get through this pandemic? And honestly, we did. We got through it. From an overall market standpoint, that we know that many businesses were able to fare the storm, given some of the government programs that were enacted and enacted very quickly at that point in time. But now we're at the crux of that type of program running out. And let's dive in a little bit more, because you speak to this so well, in what the PPP program has done to businesses and what to look out for, knowing that those programs are ending for potential clients of staffing agencies.
Sure. You got a couple of things. And in my opinion, that the PPP, and even in my opinion, to a bigger degree, even the EIDL loans, which are the economic injury loans, that the government pumped out massive amounts of money specifically to small business. And the first time the U.S. government, you've always had the bank bailouts, you've had the auto bailouts. Well, this go around, small businesses are the ones that got injected with massive amounts of cash. And in my opinion, that's probably why you have some of the inflation. Certainly, in my opinion, that's why you have a lot of the inflation. But secondly, that may be also why you're not seeing the unemployment records drop, because you're not seeing mass layoffs because everybody's sitting on a lot of cash. Well, everybody's familiar with the PPP, which you got, you know, whatever, depending on the industry, you got 2.5 or 3.5 times or 3.5 months salary on your employees. Great program. And in my opinion, especially the first injection, kept people on the payroll and kept the infrastructure there. Brilliant program that I thought did a magnificent job. What they also did is they used an economic injury loan, which is typically used, let's say I'm originally from the Northern Gulf Coast. Down there, I'm in Atlanta, have been in Atlanta for the last 30 some odd years, but I still have a place down in Gulf Shores. And occasionally there's a hurricane that comes through. And when a hurricane comes through, the government, the SBA goes down there and says, hey, Mr. Restaurant Owner, hey, Mr. Condo Rental or Realtor or whatever, we know that business is going to be bad for the next year or so, and you've obviously suffered some losses. We're going to give you loans that are 30-year terms, so you have very small payments. And that they were at 3.75. Well, what 3.5% or 3.75% interest? What they did was when COVID hit, they said this is an economic injury disaster. So they made it available for the entire country, and you had to be a small business and some parameters. But what it in essence started out with, you could get a maximum of $150,000. Without a personal guarantee, which is crazy. Go to your bank, tell them you want $150,000, try to go get without a personal guarantee, would never happen. Well, as they pumped in the second round and the third round of money, this thing got up to literally $1 trillion, give or take 100,000 one way or the other. And what they did was they expanded it eventually to where you could get $2 million. Now, per company. Now, the way that they did it was under 200,000, you weren't personally guaranteed, but your company was secured. Over up to $500,000, you didn't have to have a means test, which basically means you didn't have to show you had the ability to pay it back. So if you had been in business and your credit was just reasonably clean, because I think the lowest credit rating was like 660, and they even dropped that towards the end, you could get up to $500,000. Now, once you started getting above that, you had to show a little bit of the ability to pay back. But my point being is companies that would have, that have operated, an average company had 30 days worth of cash flow as a general rule is on average what small businesses had, all of a sudden got injected with up to 2 years worth of expenses in cash. Now, there's some parameters where you couldn't invest it. It had to sit in, interest-bearing or non-interest-bearing accounts. But my point being is so much money was injected into the small business sector that everybody benefited. Even if you didn't get the EIDL loans, you were operating within the harbor that raises all ships. The market had so much cash in there, so people started adding employees. They started expanding, buying, and things on those lines. Also, in my opinion, if you take a look at what's really gone through on inflation, such as houses and between that, and I'm in Atlanta, it may be different in different parts of the country, but between that $500,000 and $1 million house, houses just went crazy. Well, that's typically where small business owners live. And now you couldn't take that money that you received from the EIDL and go put a pool in your backyard. But if you had $100,000 sitting as your nest egg or your cash flow, cash to where something happened, your emergency fund, all of a sudden that freed up that money to go into the market, go buy that pool, because now you were injected with, $500,000 to $2 million from the government at a 3.75% interest rate. So we've been operating on that. Now, what the government has done is they then did, of course, all the programs at the end of last year. And a lot of that money starting now to dry up. Everybody's bought their pool. They've added their employees and things on those lines. So now you're seeing it, and you're seeing it also in the medical side because, and there again, I think medical is a great opportunity, but with a great opportunity, there's also some risk involved because the government had pumped so much money for obvious reasons during the pandemic into small practices, small facilities, hospitals, rehab centers, old folk homes, whatever you want to call them. And so there's been so much money. Well, now what's happening is that money's being pulled back out of the system. So now everybody's having to operate on what they actually are generating in profits. And I can tell you one of the things that I've never seen in 30 years of business is we're seeing balances come in here for collections. Now, the good news is they're paying. But we're seeing $1 million, $2 million balances. And these aren't coming in from the big nationals. You know, we have one client that turned over $1.5 million account. Thank goodness that we're getting it collected. I doubt they did $3 million a year. So literally half of his total revenue is tied up in this one group or this one facility. If we didn't collect it, he probably would go out of business. Now, there are certain things that the staffing industry need to do. And that's why I'm saying treat it as though you're loaning money, because you have to get back to the fundamentals, because all of this cash that's been in there to where it's almost been monopoly money, that's drying up. And so now your clients have to actually pay you on what they're generating. You know, because in my opinion, the only companies that, or the only industry that was really, really, really affected adversely, of course, was the hospitality industry, you know, during COVID. That obviously was the target.
Huge hit.
But everybody else, if you talk to most folks, they've had pretty good years. Well, yeah. Now, you know, with the government, you know, raising interest rates, you're going to start seeing the ripple effect through the mortgage industry, the realty industry, and things on those lines. So if you're in that industry, if you're in the medical industry, still great opportunities, but you need to be careful, because their cash flow is starting to shrink up. And they're probably now, at the end of this year, they start having to make the payments back on those EIDL loans. It's almost been like with the kids that had the student loans.
The federal student loans, right.
Well, the SBA has paused all payments. Well, at the end of this year, those payments have to start being paid back. So if they have tight cash flow, it's about to get just a little tighter.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and thank you for painting the picture truly of what it has been, particularly for the SMB landscape the last couple of years. You know, you put it perfectly. The money is drying up. And now what? So let's talk about then some of the simple best practices that you can implement. You have to treat this as a loan. What are some of those actual steps that you can do to put systems in place in your processes to almost have a red flag alert system on practice, common practices to look for, and how to build my team and equip them to know what to look for?
Well, you have to balance it with sales and marketing. And,
yeah. And it's a delicate balance, right? You need money coming in and you need money coming out.
And you know, I have a lot of clients say, Wilson, if I pull a credit check on everybody, it's going to take too much time to do it. We're going to lose the job order to another competitor. I get it. And I probably even agree with that. But given them access to staffing immediately doesn't mean you're giving them an unlimited credit limit. What I tell all of our clients is take whatever that number is. Is it 5,000 that you could take a hit and not go out of business? Is it 10,000? Set some arbitrary number that if you took a hit, you wouldn't be happy about it, but it's not going to hurt you. Typically in the staffing industry, that's somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000. So, okay, you have a policy that anybody that can fog a mirror that calls you gets $5,000 in credit. In the interim, what you do is you send over and you tell them, hey, we've set you up a $5,000 credit line. If you're going to go above that per week, then we need to get this credit application filled out. And so, you know, you get the three trade references, three people that they're dealing with, and you get their banking information. And I still recommend, whether you utilize our credit screens or Dun & Bradstreet's or Experian, you go ahead and pull a business credit report, because you need the other side of the coin. I wouldn't extend credit based on what you find on our credit report or Dun & Bradstreet's, because it's not going to give you the entire information, but it will let you know, do they have any tax liens? How are they paying their institutional creditors? Are there any lawsuits? Because staffing firms, if a staffing firm's not paid, they don't pick up the phone and call Dun & Bradstreet and say, hey, this guy's 90 days behind and he owes me $10,000. Nobody does. Where staffing firms show up is on collections or either on lawsuits. So understand, if you're looking at a Dun & Bradstreet, you're seeing how they're paying Wells Fargo, how they're paying American Express, how they're paying those institutional creditors. And quite frankly, if cash gets tight, they're still going to pay those guys. You're going to be the ones that they don't. So you want three trade references that you can pick up the phone. Also, you want their banking information. And you call their bank and you say, hey, can you give me a rating? You know, what's their average balance and things on those lines? And the bank will typically say, well, yeah, they, you know, they're satisfactory. They carry a mid five, which is a mid five figure, you know, balance, which is, you know, 40 to 60,000, or they say they carry a low four. That means they're carrying, you know, $5,000 to $8,000 somewhere in there. So whenever they say a low four, it's a low four figure balance. So my point being is somebody could be a wonderful five or a $10,000 credit risk. But if you take a look at their credit, they'd be a horrible $50,000 credit risk. And so if they only have $10,000 in the bank, why on earth would you give them $100,000 in staffing? You'd want to do like the credit card companies do. The credit card companies give you the credit based on your ability to pay back, not your need. And so enacting a credit policy that's simple and easy to follow, and then you're pulling some type of external credit check that's going to give you public records. And then also something as simple as a Google search, you will be shocked what a simple Google search will be. There's one where we pulled, because we always pull the credit when a debtor comes in, and we pull a Google search. We found a search where a client of one of our clients, one of the debtors that came through, was literally in a high-speed chase and went through, and it's a hysterical video on that stuff, but goes through a car wash with the police following her through and all of that good stuff. So
great. So, my goodness.
My point being is something that on a simple Google search, you may find some information that says, you know what, I don't want to deal with these folks.
And I think it's amazing to just let the audience know. I mean, everything that you went through just now, it doesn't take days to accomplish. It's something that with the right systems in place is done in a matter of minutes, folks. It really is very simple and quick. Now, when it comes to, okay, so that's the preliminary approach. Now we have the new client. We're framing up an agreement with that client. What are some of the best practices that we can make when we are negotiating agreement terms with the client, aside from due upon receipt, right?
I get it. You know, one thing that I always recommend is whatever invoice software you're using, whether it's QuickBooks or any of their competitors, instead of having net 30 days or net 10 days, if you want to see your cash flow increase, put a specific day on it. So instead of, like you're talking about, the average day outstanding of 54 days, that's because everybody has 30 days on it. And is that 30 days from invoice or when they get it into accounts payable? What you want to do is
when it's approved in their system. And
there you go. There you go. So if your terms are net 30, which they probably need to be closer to net 14 or 15, put a specific date. So if it's August 1st, it would be due on August 16th or 15th. That way, if it takes a week for the accounting department to get it, they look and say, oh, it's due on the 16th. They enter it in and put that date in the payable. So that's going to speed up your cash flow. The other thing that you want to put in there, and there's some wording that makes you a secured creditor. You can typically put that in your credit application. And you know, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but it basically says that, you know, you have a secured interest in the company. And what it does is, like, if you go and buy a house, they put a mortgage on it, and that, you know, if you can do a courthouse search, commercial debt is very similar. And if you've ever gone to your bank and gotten a $50,000 credit line, I can assure you they have filed what's referred to as a UCC-1. I don't want to get too down into the weeds, but it's a secured interest that makes you a secured party. Now, it doesn't ensure that you get paid, but if they go to sell the company, you have to get paid. If they go bankrupt, you know, you get the whole list that looks, you know, 4 inches thick of all of the unsecured creditors, and you may only have three or four secured creditors. Literally, the only difference is the other companies have filed that UCC-1. Uh-huh. Also, you want to put in there that they agree to pay reasonable attorney and or collection cost. And you also want to be able to put in your interest rates, you know, 1.5% a month or whatever the legal amount is in your state. Because as bizarre as it says, if you don't have something where they sign off, where you're agreeing or where they're agreeing to pay you the interest or the attorney's fees, or all of that, you legally cannot ask for it.
Wow. Wow. That's fascinating. And I want to continue the evolvement here. So, you know, we've done the preliminary notions. We are setting up and negotiating the right terms. Now we're invoicing. Okay. So when it comes to proper collection efforts, what would you recommend to the team to make sure that invoices are issued and collected on?
Well, the one thing that you want to do is you want to have a system that's not people dependent, because the second it becomes people dependent, then it's just, you know, you have
margin for human error, right?
Yeah, it's going to get lost. What I always recommend is you, of course, do the invoice with a specific date. Also, you can create, you know, a three collection letter or a pre-collection letter that isn't aggressive. It isn't abusive. It just lets the debtor know or your client know that you know that they're behind. What I always, something that we used to do years ago when we oversaw credit departments before we just got to where it wasn't logistically possible, is we would recommend that they print out three postcards, and you could even use, you know, a yellow sheet of construction paper, a red sheet and a green sheet. And the first green sheet, you cut it into three quarters. You put it in with your statement. You can also just do it with an email or a letter that goes in with your invoice. And if they're beyond a week, beyond that 16 days or 14 days or whatever, you put that note in there, or you have it where the email gets triggered. And it basically says, hey, our terms are net 14 days. There's an invoice that's now due. Can you please make sure it's in your system and let us know when it's going to get paid? You know, just kind of a friendly reminder. If you don't get a response back, then about somewhere between 10 days to 2 weeks later, it says, hey, we sent you out a notice a couple of weeks ago. If you would, please take a look at it. Let us know if there's a problem. Here's my number. Call me. I'll assume it'll get wrapped up here in the next 10 days. If there's a problem and I'm not going to have it in 10 days, then just give me a shout. And then you have the one that goes out, and this would be the red construction paper. It says, hey, you're now 30, you're now 40 days behind or whatever. Our terms are net, you know, 14 days. I need this payment sent to us immediately. Here's our tracking number. You can send it to me via FedEx or give your ACH information. But those three letters go out, and that's a version of the old collection letters that this industry that I'm in has been built on. But it's very friendly, and it also trains your client, because one of the stories that I think about is a client that we were overseeing their credit department says it's not going to work, and we had the postcards. I said, well, let's try it. And so the first time we sent out the postcards, we probably sent out 75 or 100 postcards. The following week, we sent out about 80. Within a few months, we were only sending out three or four postcards a month, because we started training everybody. The reason that your accounts receivable are sitting out at 54 days in the average is because that's what they train their clients to pay them on. This will shorten up the amount of time and also reduce your exposure to that very large account going bad, because most clients, you know, whenever I have a client say, yeah, Wilson, we always do really good. You know, we typically keep it around that 10 or 20,000, but I took my eye off the ball. I had no idea this company owed me $150,000. I need your help. So you need something that triggers that to keep that $150,000 issue from arising.
So you said something that I think is super interesting here, and that's to minimize the amount of involvement in human oversight, right? So in some essence, you're looking at some form of technology that can help and automate certain practices. And do you want to give a shout out to any technologies out there that you think are useful in this space?
You know, I mean, all of the CRMs have some of that technology there. And then, you know, just the automatic billing, you know, like our collection letters go out, automatically until we manually stop them. Now, occasionally, do we have a letter go out that shouldn't? Very rarely. But I'd rather have that than to not have the letter go out. So you do automate it. Now, you know, one of the technologies over on the finding backdoor hires, which is a totally different subject, but we've automated, you know, with that company, finding backdoor hires and misplacement fees. But there are tons of applicant tracking systems or CRMs that you could automate that process. But whatever it is, automation to me is much safer than having human oversight.
Person press send and send and send and send.
Exactly. And sending an email or putting a little postcard in with the billing will help. And it typically gets done. Sometimes people get a little wishy-washy, especially when it's not their money, not wanting to call and bug somebody on a payment. And typically the owner, whenever they're having a cash flow issue and payrolls next week, that's where they take the stack of invoices, lock themselves in the office and make collection calls. That's not a good practice to have. You need to have a system to where, you know, the automation's on the front side.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So super interesting. And I think a cornerstone, and I want to just traject into a different area. The cornerstone of this country is truly the entrepreneurial spirit that's behind the SMB, the small to medium-sized business. Of course, this is a corporate conglomerate home of many, many billions and trillions dollars worth of companies, but also it's attainable to the average SMB. But I'm saying all of this to take a step back and truly take a look at bankruptcies. Yes. And our notion on negativity when it is connotated to bankruptcy, sure. But truly, how attainable is bankruptcies with the average everyday SMB that we may be doing business with within the staffing space? Can you delve into that a little bit further?
Absolutely. The one thing about bankruptcy, unless it's a larger company, most companies, like 98% of the companies that go out of business, never go near bankruptcy because they don't have to. And I don't want to get too far in the weeds because there's a lot of nuances to it. But Adams, Evans, and Ross is a corporation. You're a corporation or you're an LLC. Everybody, that business, the government views that business as its own entity. I'll get a call from a client on occasion that says, hey, I've got somebody, they changed their name, but I know where the owner is. And it's okay. As soon as they tell me they changed their name, no, the company that they dealt with went out of business. This is the new company that's taken its place. Now, there's some things that you can do to where you can claim that it's a continuance of business and all of that, but you have to work off the understanding that you're dealing with the corporation or the LLC, not with the individual. That's where you get the personal guarantees. That's another safeguard. If a company is under 2 years old, I would always get a personal guarantee because if they're not willing to guarantee their business and payroll, why the heck would you be? Right. But what I would recommend is just understanding that you're dealing with that business. Very few companies, especially on the small business side, ever go into bankruptcy because they don't have to. They just shut the corporation down. Now, the creditors can go ahead and sue that corporation, but it's now an empty shell. So bankruptcy never really is an issue. Now, if it's a larger company that has assets, that has receivables and different assets and secured creditors, that's where bankruptcy comes into. But 98% of the small businesses, they just simply shut down one corporation and open up another one. Interesting statistic, and I'm a huge fan of small business. And you know, one of the guys that I follow, Damon Johns, talks about is that it's entrepreneurship is a great equalizer. It doesn't care if you're male, female, nationality, or race. It's all equal. And I am. So in agreement with that, especially coming from the South Alabama roots that I came from, it gives you opportunities that you wouldn't have elsewhere. But the one thing that most successful business owners have shut down two or three other companies on average, which means that their business, they never went bankrupt. And sometimes they do, but they tried something, it didn't work, they shut that company down, maybe creditors got paid, maybe they didn't, but keep in mind that small businesses go out of business every day, and typically for every successful entrepreneur, they've had three, on average, three businesses behind them, and so you need to realize that it's managing risk. You don't want to get caught being owed by one of those failures versus one of those successes.
Wow. That's awesome. That's awesome. Wilson, you are just a plethora of knowledge, and it really is awesome sitting down with you today and just going through what is not the most exciting part of what we do business, but gosh, a very, very critical element in how we do business. Let's just take it a step back and get to know you personally. What are some of your whys out there on why you do what you do every single day? In this very interesting business that we are in?
Well, you know, the biggest thing is, you know, I love entrepreneurship, and you know, we have Adams, Evans, and Ross, but we're also part, I have another company, which is Eli Global, that owns some of the other entities. And to me, that's how I recreate. I play golf and then I run. And both of those are probably for self-medication, but how I recreate, and I'm horribly one-sided, is probably on the business side. And I'm also a just an absolute student of some self-help, and then also on a lot of marketing books, because you need to have good practices on the backside, but you also have to have a predictable way of bringing in clients and generating revenue. And so I spend a disproportionate amount of time, you know, listening to, you know, whether it be, you know, Garrett Gunderson on some of his stuff, or Russell Brunson with ClickFunnels and things on those lines, because at being 57 years old, the medium changes. You know, you go from, you know, magazines to probably Facebook or in digital. The medium changes, but the messaging is still all the same, but you still have to have a fundamental understanding of what those mediums are and how to use them. And so that's the biggest thing that scares me, is one day you don't hone those skills and you become irrelevant. And it happens much, much quicker than you would think, because I can remember when we started our business, the internet, at least the way that we know it now, in 1992, the internet didn't exist. So there's been a lot of changes over the last 30 years.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. What an interesting story from a young Alabama boy in the Southern Alabama parts now, to running Adams, Evans, and Ross and many other business endeavors. Wilson, thank you so much for spending some time with us. Where can our audience find out more about what you do, and how can we get in contact with you?
Sure. The company that I'm most involved in is going to be Adams, Evans, and Ross. And that's where, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm a collection guy. That's kind of what we've always done. And, you know, my daughter, which is one of our staff attorneys, is also within the company as well. But you can reach us at staffingdebt.com, which is our website, or 800-452-5287. And I'm at extension 6578. That's over on the collection side. If you need to find backdoor hires or missed fees, that's going to be backdoorhires.com. And that will give you some information on that product as well.
Awesome. Great. Well, thank you for spending some time with us, Wilson. And thank you to our listeners. As I wrap up every single episode, I always say this, time is honestly the most valuable gift that we can give to one another in this very fast information age that we're listening and tuning into every single day. So we appreciate everyone for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
All right, guys, we'll see you on the next episode of the Ivy Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.